it must be enforced by a penal sanction. Declared penalty for disobedience upholds the authority of the Creator and keeps prominently in view the responsibility of the creature. It makes clear the just supremacy of the one and the due subordination of the other. The moral sense in man, even in fallen man, bears witness to the meekness of this basic fact. Conscience is a prospective principle. Its decisions are by no means final, but are only the prelude of a higher sentence to be pronounced in a higher court. Conscience derives its power from anticipations of the future. It brings before its possessor the dread tribunal of eternal justice and almighty power. It summons us into the awful presence of a righteous, loving, and sin-hating God. It testifies to an ultimate reward for right doing and an ultimate punishment for wrongdoing. John Thornwell declared, "When a man of principle braves calumny, reproach, and persecution, when he stands unshaken in the discharge of duty amid public opposition and private treachery, when no machinations of malice or seductions of flattery can cause him to bend from the path of integrity, that must be a powerful support through which he can bid defiance to the storms of fate. He must feel that a strong arm is underneath him, and though the eye of sense can perceive nothing in his circumstances but terror, confusion, and dismay, he sees his mountain surrounded by chariots of fire and horses of fire, which sustain his soul in unbroken tranquility. In the approbation of his conscience there is lifted up the light of the divine countenance upon him, and he feels the strongest assurance that all things shall work together for his ultimate good. Conscience anticipates the rewards of the just, and in the conviction which it inspires of divine protection, lays the foundation of heroic fortitude. When, on the contrary, the remembrance of some fatal crime rankles in the breast, the sinner's dreams are disturbed by invisible ministers of vengeance, and the fall of a leaf can strike him with horror. In every shadow he sees a ghost, in every tread he hears an avenger of blood, and in every sound the trump of doom." What is it that invests his conscience with such terrible power to torment? Is there nothing here but the natural operation of a simple and original instinct? Who does not see that the alarm and agitation and fearful forebodings of the sinner arise from the terrors of an offended judge and insulted lawgiver? An approving conscience is the consciousness of right, of having done what has been commanded, and of being now entitled to the favor of the judge. Remorse is the sense of ill desert. The criminal does not feel that his present pangs are his punishment. It is the future, the unknown and portentous future, that fills him with consternation. He deserves ill, and the dread of receiving it makes him tremble." Unquote. Let there be no uncertainty on this point. Were it possible to remove the penalty from the divine law, we should be wresting the scepter from the hands of deity, divesting him of power to enforce his just demands, denuding him of the essential dignity of his character, reducing him to a mere suppliant at the feet of his creatures. Alas, modern theology, if theology it deserves to be called, presents to men a parody of God, who commands the respect of none, who is disrobed of his august and glorious majesty, who, so far from doing his will in the army of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth, is pictured as a kindly petitioner, seeking favors at the hands of worms of the dust. such a God, in quotes, has no powerful voice which shakes the earth and makes guilty rebels quail, but only offers entreaties which may be despised with impunity. Unless God be able to enforce his will, he ceases to be God. If he speaks with authority, resistless power stands ready to support his command. And the Lord God commanded the man, saying, "Of every tree of the garden thou mayest freely eat, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil thou shalt not eat of it." Genesis 2:16-17. There was the original command given to man at the dawn of human history. It surely was uttered in a tone which carried the conviction that it must be obeyed. "For in the day that thou eatest thereof, thou shalt surely die." There was the penal sanction enforcing the authority of the lawgiver, the plainly announced penalty for transgression. Man was not left in ignorance or uncertainty of what would follow the forbidden act. The loss of God's favor, the incurring of his sore displeasure, certain and unescapable destruction would be the portion of the disobedient. And that awful threat was no isolated and exceptional one, but the enunciation of an abiding principle which God has constantly pressed upon men all through his word. "The soul that sinneth, it shall die. The wages of sin is death." Even when the Savior commissioned his servants to go forth and preach the gospel to every creature, he expressly bade them to make it known, "He that believeth not shall be damned." Such a God is not to be trifled with. Let us digress for a moment. In view of what has been said here, the discerning reader will hardly need for us to point out to him the unspeakable solemnity, the immeasurable awfulness, the consummate folly of the course followed by the vast majority of the pulpits during the past 50 years. Even where the requirements of the moral law were insisted upon, its fearful penal sanction was scarcely ever pressed. It has either been flatly denied that God will consign to everlasting woe all who have trampled upon his commandments and died impenitent of their rebellion, or else a guilty silence was maintained thereon, and in its stead there was presented a one-sided portrayal of the divine character, all the emphasis being thrown upon his love and mercy. Disastrous indeed must be the consequences of such a course, and disastrous indeed has it proved. An insulted deity is now giving us to reap what we have sown. A law which is not enforced by penalties will not be obeyed. True alike of God's law or man's, God's law will exert very little restraining influence upon the unregenerate if fear of the wrath to come is not definitely before their minds. And the multitude will have little respect for the statutes of the realm once they cease to regard the magistrate with terror. Romans 13:2-4. For generations past, there has been scarcely anything from the pulpit to inspire fear of God, and now there is practically no fear of magistracy left. Respect for the divine authority was not faithfully proclaimed and enforced, and now there is only a mere pretense of respect for human authority. The terrible penalty for disobeying God's law, endless suffering in the lake of fire, was not plainly and frequently held before the pew, and now we are beholding a miserable parody, a mere formal pretense of enforcing the prescribed penalties for violations of human laws. during the course of the last century, churchgoers grew less and less afraid of the consequences of breaking God's precepts, and the masses, even children, are now less and less afraid of transgressing the laws of our country. Witness not merely the leniency, but the utter laxity of most of our magistrates in either dismissing offenders with a warning or a trifling fine. Witness not only many murderers sentenced to death with strong recommendation for mercy, and the increasing number of those whose capital punishment is remitted, but witness the pathetic spectacle of governments afraid to act firmly, making appeals and requests instead of using their authority. And what we are now beholding in the civil realm is the inevitable repercussion of what took place in the religious. Having sown the wind, a righteous God is now giving us to reap the whirlwind. Nor can there be any hope of a return to law and order, either between the nations or in our civil life, until the law of God is again given its proper place in the churches, until the authority of the lawgiver is respected, until the penalty for breaking his law is proclaimed. Returning to our more immediate discussion, let it be pointed out that the fall did not, to the slightest degree, cancel man's responsibility. How could it? Man is just as much under the authority of God now as he was in Eden. He is still as truly the subject of divine command as ever he was, and therefore as much bound to render perfect and ceaseless obedience to the divine law. The responsibility of man, be he unfallen or fallen, is that of a subject to his sovereign. They who imagine that his own willful sin has cancelled man's obligation do but evince how completely darkened is their judgment. Since God continues to be man's rightful lord and man his lawful subject, since he still possesses the right to command and we are still under obligation to obey, it should not be thought strange that God deals with man according to this relationship and actually enjoins upon him an obedience to his law, though he be no longer able to render it. No, the fall of man most certainly has neither annulled nor impaired man's responsibility. Why should it? It was not God who took from man his spiritual strength and deprived him of his ability. Man was originally endowed with power to meet the righteous requirements of his Maker, and it was by his own madness and wickedness he threw away that power. Does a human monarch forfeit his right to demand allegiance from his subjects as soon as they turn rebels? Certainly not. It is his prerogative to demand that they throw down the weapons of their warfare and return to their original fealty. Has then the King of Kings no such right to require that lawless rebels become loyal subjects? We say again, it was not God who stripped man of original righteousness, for he had lost it before God passed sentence upon him, as his "I was naked," Genesis 3:10 acknowledged. If inability cancelled man's obligation, then there would be no sin in the world, and consequently no judgment here or hereafter. For God to allow that fallen creatures are absolved from loving him with all their hearts would be to abrogate his government. God's sovereignty and man's responsibility are never confounded in the scriptures, but from the two trees in the midst of Eden's garden, the tree of life and the tree of knowledge of good and evil, Genesis 2:9 onwards, are placed in juxtaposition. Human responsibility is the necessary corollary of divine sovereignty. since God be the Creator, since He be sovereign ruler over all, and since man is but a creature and a subject, there is no escape from his accountability unto his Maker. If we be asked to define more definitely responsible for what, we answer, man is obligated to answer to the relationship which exists between him and his Creator. He occupies a place of creaturehood, subordination, complete dependency, and therefore must he acknowledge God's dominion, submit to his authority, and love him with all his heart and strength. The discharge of human responsibility is simply the recognition of God's rights and acting accordingly, a rendering to him of his unquestionable due. Responsibility is entirely a matter of relationship and the discharge of those obligations which that relationship entails. When a man takes unto himself a wife, he enters into a new relationship and incurs new obligations, and his marital responsibility lies in the fulfillment of those obligations. If a child be given to him, a further relationship is involved with added obligations to both his wife and child, and his parental responsibility consists of the faithful meeting of those obligations. Once it be known who God is and what is man's relationship to him, the question of his responsibility is settled once and for all. God is our owner and governor, possessed of absolute authority over us, and this must be acknowledged by us in deed as well as word. Thus, we are responsible to be in complete subjection to the will of our Maker and Lord, to employ in His service the faculties He has given us, to use the means He has appointed, and to improve the opportunities and advantages He had vouchsafed us. Our whole duty is to glorify God. From this definition, it should be crystal clear that the fall did not and could not, to the slightest degree, cancel or impair human responsibility. The fall has not altered the fundamental relationship subsisting between Creator and creature. God is the owner of sinful man as truly and as fully as he was of sinless man. God is still our sovereign, and we are still his subjects. God's absolute dominion over us pertains as strictly now as it did in Eden. Though man has lost his power to obey, God has not lost his right to demand. To argue that inability cancels responsibility is the height of absurdity, because an intoxicated employee is incapable of performing his duties, is his master deprived of the right to demand the same? Man cannot blame God for the wretched condition in which he now finds himself. The entire onus rests on the creature, for his moral impotency is the immediate effect and result of his own wrongdoing. God's right to command and man's obligation to render perfect and perpetual obedience remain unshaken. God gave to man his substance, Luke 15, but he spent it in riotous living. Nevertheless, God may justly challenge his own. If an earthly master gives a servant money and sends him forth to purchase goods, may he not lawfully demand those goods, even though that servant spent the money in debauchery and gambling? God supplied Adam with a suitable stock, but he trifled it away. Surely then, God is not to suffer because of the creature's folly, be deprived of his right because of man's crime? The fact that man is a spiritual embezzler cannot destroy God's authority to require what the creature cannot be excused from. A debtor who cannot pay the debts which he has incurred remains under the obligation of paying. God not only possesses the right to demand from man the debt of obedience, but from Genesis 3 to the last chapter of the New Testament, He exercises and enforces that right and will yet make it publicly manifest before an assembled universe. Though it be true that man himself is entirely to blame for the wretched spiritual condition in which he now finds himself, that the guilt of his depravity and powerlessness lies at his own door, yet we must not lose sight of the fact that his very impotency is a penal infliction, a divine judgment upon his original rebellion. Moral inability is the necessary effect of disobedience, for sin is essentially destructive, being opposed to all that is holy. God has so ordered it that the effects which it has produced in man furnishes a powerful witness to and an unmistakable demonstration of the exceeding sinfulness of sin and the dreadfulness of the malady which it produces. Sin not only defiles but enervates. It not only renders man obnoxious in the pure eyes of his Maker, but it saps man of his original strength to use his faculties aright. And the more he now indulges in sin, the more he increases his inability to walk uprightly. Further light is cast upon the problem of fallen man's responsibility by obtaining a right view of the precise nature of his inability. Let us begin by pointing out what it does not consist of. First, the moral inability of fallen man lies not in the absence of any of those faculties which are necessary to constitute him a moral agent. By his transgression, man lost both his spiritual purity and power, but he lost none of his original faculties. Fallen man possesses every faculty with which unfallen man was endowed. He is still a rational creature. He has an understanding to think with, affections capable of being exercised, a conscience to discern between right and wrong, a will to make choice with. Because he is in possession of such endowments, man has faculties suited to the substance of the divine commands. Because he is a moral agent, man is under moral government and must yet render an account unto the supreme governor. At this point, notice must be taken of an error which obtains in the minds of some, tending to obscure and undermine the truth of fallen man's unimpaired responsibility. God declared that in the day Adam ate of the forbidden fruit, he should surely die, which has been wrongly understood to mean that his spirit would be extinguished, and that consequently, while the natural man possesses a soul, he has no spirit, and cannot have until he is born again. This is quite wrong. In Scripture, death signifies separation and never annihilation. At physical death, the soul is not exterminated but separated from the body. And the spiritual death of Adam was not the extinction of any part of his being, but the severance of his fellowship with a holy God. In consequence thereof, Adam's descendants are born into this world dead in trespasses and sins, which is defined as being alienated from the life of God through the ignorance that is in them, because of the blindness of their hearts. Ephesians 4, verse 18. When the Father said of the wayward one, "This my son was dead and is alive again," Luke 15:24. He most certainly did not mean he had ceased to exist, but simply that the prodigal had been in the far country and had now returned. The lake of fire into which the wicked are cast is termed the second death, Revelation 20:14, because they are punished with everlasting destruction from the presence of the Lord and from the glory of His power. 2 Thessalonians 1, verse 9. That the natural man is possessed of a spirit is clear from the Lord, which formeth the spirit of man within him. Zechariah 12:1. From what man knoweth the things of a man, save the spirit of man which is in him? 1 Corinthians 2:11. And from the spirit shall return unto God who gave it. Ecclesiastes 12:7. It is then a serious mistake to say, when Adam died in Eden, that any portion of his tripartite nature ceased to exist. Fallen man, we repeat, possesses all the faculties which unfallen man had. When the scriptures affirm, they that are in the flesh cannot please God, Romans 8:8, it is not because they lack the necessary faculties. That cannot must be understood in a way which comports fully with fallen man's responsibility. Otherwise, we should be guilty of making one verse contradict another. The cannot of Romans 8:8 and similar passages is in no wise analogous to the cannot walk of a man who has lost his legs, or the cannot see of one who is deprived of his eyes. In such a case, he cannot because he has not the requisite faculties or organs. A person who was devoid of such members at his birth could not possibly be held accountable for the non-exercise of them. But the moral impotency of the sinner is far otherwise. He does possess moral faculties, and the reason he fails to use them for the glory of God is solely because of his hatred of him, because of the corruption of his nature, the enmity of his mind, the perversity of his will, and for that he is responsible. For a man to be so besotted by strong drink that he cannot help getting inebriated, so far from excusing him, adds to his condemnation. For a man to give way to speaking what is untrue, forming the habit of telling falsehoods until he becomes such a confirmed liar that he is incapable of uttering the truth, only evidences the awful depths of his depravity. But ponder carefully the nature of his incapability. It is not because he has lost any faculty, for he still possesses the organs of speech, but because he has sunk so low, he can no longer use those organs to good purpose. Thus it is with the natural man and his incapability of pleasing his Maker. Man is endowed with moral faculties, but he perverts them, puts them to a wrong use. He has the same heart for loving God as to hate Him, the same members to serve Him with as he now employs in his disobedience. Stephen Charnock, 1660, wrote, "It is strange if God should invite the trees or beasts to repent, because they have no foundation in their nature to entertain commandments and invitations to obedience and repentance. For trees have no sense, and beasts have no reason to discern the difference between good and evil. But God addresses Himself to men that have senses open to objects, understandings to know, wills to move, affections to embrace objects. These understandings are open to anything but that which God doth command. Their wills can will anything but that which God doth propose. The commandment is proportioned to their rational faculty, and the faculty is proportioned to the excellency of the command. We have affections as love and desire. In the commands of loving God and loving our neighbor, there is only a change of the object of our affections required. The faculties are not weakly, but by viciousness of nature, which is of our own introduction. It is strange, therefore, that we should excuse ourselves and pretend we are not to be blamed, because God's command is impossible to be observed, when the defect lies not in the want of a rational foundation, but in our own giving up ourselves to the flesh and the love of it, and in willful refusal of applying our faculties to their proper objects, when we can employ those faculties with all vehemence about those things which have no commerce with the gospel. Unquote. This is a suitable place for us to mention and correct a mistake which occurs in some of our earlier writings. Lacking the light which God has now vouchsafed us, we then taught, one, that fallen man still possessed a natural ability to render unto God the obedience which he requires, though he lacks the necessary moral ability, and that, two, it is because man be possessed of such natural ability, he is a responsible creature. The first mistake was really more a matter of terms than anything else, for all that we meant to signify by natural ability was the possession of faculties which capacitated man to act as a moral agent. Nevertheless, as wrong terms conduce to wrong ideas, we must correct them. The second was an error in doctrine due to our crass ignorance. In the two articles preceding this one, we have shown that the basis of human responsibility consists not of anything in man, but rather in his relationship to God, and that the faculties which constitute him a moral agent merely fit him to discharge his responsibility. Many able writers, in their efforts to solve the problem presented by the moral impotency and yet moral responsibility of fallen man, had recourse to the distinction between natural and moral ability and inability. They did not see how a man could be held accountable for his actions unless he was in some sense capable of performing his duty. That capability they ascribed to his being in possession of all the faculties requisite for the performance of obedience to the divine law. But it is now clear to us that these men employed the wrong term when they designated this possession of faculties a natural ability, for the simple but sufficient reason that fallen man has lost the power or strength to use those faculties aright. And it is surely a misuse of terms to predicate ability of one who is without strength. To affirm that the natural man possesses ability of any sort is really a denial of his total depravity. In the second place, it should be pointed out that the moral inability of the natural man is not brought about by any external compulsion. It is an utterly erroneous idea to suppose that the natural man possesses or may possess a genuine desire and determination to do that which is pleasing unto God and to abstain from what is displeasing to him, but that a power ab extra, something outside himself, thwarts him and obliges him to act contrary to his inclinations. Were such the case, man would be neither a moral agent nor a responsible creature. If some physical law operated upon man, like that which regulates the planets, if some external violence, like the wind, carried men forward whether they desired not to go, they would be exempted from guilt. Those who are compelled to do what they are decidedly averse to could not be justly held accountable for such actions. One of the essential elements of moral agency is that the agent act without external compulsion, in accord with his own desires. The mind must be capable of considering the motives to action which are placed before it, and in choosing its own course. By motives, we mean those reasons or inducements which influence to choice and action. Thus, that which would be a powerful motive to the view of one mind would be no motive at all in the view of another. The offer of a bribe would be sufficient inducement to move one judge to decide a case contrary to evidence and law, while to another, such an offer, so far in it being a motive for wrongdoing, would be highly repellent. The temptation presented by Potiphar's wife, which was firmly resisted by Joseph, would have been an inducement sufficiently powerful to have ruined many a youth of less purity of heart. It should be quite evident, then, that no external motive, inducement, or consideration can have any influence over our choices and actions except so far as they make an appeal to inclinations already existing within us. The affections of the heart act freely and spontaneously. In the very nature of the case, we cannot be compelled either to love or hate any object. Neither an infant nor an idiot is capable of weighing motives or of discerning moral values, and therefore they are not accountable creatures, amenable to law. But because man, though fallen and under the dominion of sin, is still a rational being, possessed of the power to ponder the motives set before his mind and to decide between good and evil, he is fully accountable, for he freely chooses that which, on the whole, he most prefers. Moral agency can only be destroyed by a force from without, obliging man to act contrary to his nature and inclinations. There is nothing outside of man which imposes upon him any necessity of sinning, or which prevents him turning from sin to holiness. There is no force brought to bear immediately upon man's power of volition, or even upon the connection between his volitions and his actions, which obliges him to follow the course he does. No. What man does ordinarily, he does voluntarily or spontaneously in the uncontrolled exercise of his own faculties. No compulsion whatsoever is imposed upon him. He does evil, nothing but evil, simply because he chooses to do so. The only immediate and direct cause of his doing evil is that he so wills it. Therefore, since man be a responsible creature who, without any external power forcing him to act contrary to his desires, freely rejects the good and chooses the evil, he must be held accountable for his criminal conduct. We submit that what has been pointed out considerably relieves the difficulty presented by the impotency of fallen man to meet the just requirements of God, and that if the reader will carefully ponder the same, it should be apparent to him that the problem of human inability and accountability is by no means so formidable as at first sight appears. The case of the fallen creature is seen to be vastly altered once it is clearly defined what his impotency does not consist of. It makes a tremendous difference that his inability to obey his Maker lies not in the absence of those faculties by which obedience is performed. So, too, the complexion of the case is radically changed when we perceive that man is not the victim of a hostile power outside of himself, which forces him to act contrary to his own desires and inclinations. It will thus be evident that so far from fallen man being an object of pity because of his moral impotency, he is justly to be blamed for the course which he pursues. We do not condemn a legless man because he is unable to walk, but rightly commiserate him. We do not censure a sightless man for not admiring the beauties of nature. Rather does our compassion go out unto him. But how different is the case of the natural man in connection with his bounden obligations to serve and glorify his rightful Lord. He is in possession of all the requisite faculties, but he voluntarily misuses them, deliberately following a course of madness and wickedness, and for that he is most certainly culpable. His guiltiness will appear yet more plainly in the sequel, when we behold what his moral impotency does consist of, when we consider the several elements which comprise it. A further word needs to be added to the brief statement in our last upon the error of affirming that fallen man possesses a natural ability to obey God. Most of the writers who so affirm, Calvinists, take the ground that all the natural man lacks in order to perform that which is pleasing to God is a willingness so to do. But since his mental and moral endowments are admirably suited to the substance of the divine commandments, that since man is still possessed of every faculty which is required for the discharge of his duty, he could obey God if he would. But this is far from being the case. The condition of fallen man is much worse than that. He not only will not, but he cannot please God. Such is the emphatic and unequivocal teaching of Holy Writ, and it must be held fast by us at all costs, no matter what difficulties it may seem to involve. Yet we are fully convinced that this cannot, does not, in the least measure, annul man's responsibility or render him any less blameworthy than was sinless Adam in committing his first offense. Unto them that are defiled and unbelieving is nothing pure, but even their mind and conscience is defiled. Titus 1, verse 15. In the unregenerate, the mind and conscience are under an inherent and universal incapacity to form a right judgment or come to a right decision in regard to things pertaining to God and as pertaining to Him. It is not merely that they are in the condition of one with a thick veil before his eyes, while the visive organs themselves are sound and whole, but rather are they like one whose eyes are diseased, weakened, decayed in their very internal organism. A diseased physical eye may be able to receive some glimmerings of light through darkened glasses, yet are incapable of giving safe direction. But the eyes of fallen man's heart and understanding are so seriously affected that they cannot receive or even tolerate any spiritual light at all until the great physician heals them. The solemn and terrible fact is that the brighter and more glorious be the divine light shed upon the unregenerate, the more offensive and unbearable it is to them. The eyes of our understanding are radically diseased, and it is the understanding, under false views and erroneous estimates of things, which misleads the affections and the will. How then can we, with the slightest propriety, affirm that man still possesses a natural ability to receive God's truth to the saving of his soul? In man, as created, there was a perfect adaptation of faculties and capability of receiving the divine testimony. But in man fallen, though there be a suitableness in the essential nature of his faculties to receive the testimony of God, so that his case is far superior to that of the brute beast, yet his ability to use those faculties and actually to receive God's testimony unto suitable ends is completely deranged and destroyed. The entrance of sin into man has done far more than upset his poise and disorder his affections. It has corrupted and deranged his whole being.
This Reformation audio track is a production of Stillwater's Revival Books. SWRB makes thousands of classic Reformation resources available, free and for sale, in audio, video, and printed formats. Our many free resources, as well as our complete mail order catalog, containing thousands of classic and contemporary Puritan and Reform books, tapes, and videos at great discounts, is on the web at www.swrb.com. We can also be reached by email at swrb@swrb.com, by phone at 780-450-3730, by fax at 780-468-1096, or by mail at 4710-37A Avenue, Edmonton, that's EDMONTON, Alberta, abbreviated capital A, capital B, Canada, T6L3T5. You may also request a free printed catalog. And remember that John Calvin, in defending the Reformation's regulative principle of worship, or what is sometimes called the scriptural law of worship, commenting on the words of God, "which I commanded them not, neither came into my heart," from his commentary on Jeremiah 7:31, writes, "God here cuts off from men every occasion for making evasions, since he condemns by this one phrase, 'I have not commanded them,' whatever the Jews devised. There is then no other argument needed to condemn superstitions than that they are not commanded by God. For when men allow themselves to worship God according to their own fancies, and attend not to his commands, they pervert true religion. And if this principle was adopted by the papists, all those fictitious modes of worship in which they absurdly exercise themselves would fall to the ground. It is indeed a horrible thing for the papists to seek to discharge their duties towards God by performing their own superstitions. There is an immense number of them, as it is well known, and as it manifestly appears. Were they to admit this principle, that we cannot rightly worship God except by obeying his word, they would be delivered from their deep abyss of error. The prophet's words, then, are very important, when he says that God had commanded no such thing, and that it never came to his mind, as though he had said that men assume too much wisdom when they devise what he never required, nay, what he never knew."